Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Caged In, as ever, brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. If you're new here to this podcast, what we do is we watch every single Nicolas Cage film in chronological order to determine, is he the greatest actor of all time? You join us for episode 98, 98th outing for Cage thereabouts. It's probably some very small ones. Yeah, but it's the 98th episode of this strand of the podcast, and I don't do it alone. No, I'm joined by a guest each week to help me answer that question and discuss the film. And I was very fortunate to be joined by somebody who is an absolute legend when it comes to British criticism and just a fountain of knowledge on all things film and all things Dracula. And that was pertinent for this chat because we are discussing the 2023 Chris McKay directed horror comedy Renfield. And my guest is the one and only Kim Newman. This chat is slightly different than others. We probably don't dive into the film as deeply as we would do. We just kind of talk about the Coppola's fascination with Dracula, Cage's portrayal, Cage's fascination with the character as well, and just a broad overview of Dracula within cinema, literature, and Kim's own outings with his novel series, Anno Dracula. There's all types of fun stuff to sink your teeth into. Ignore the pun, but it wasn't unintentional. That was a very unintentional pun. So, yeah. So, sit back and enjoy my chat with Kim Newman about all things Dracula and Renfield. We're heading to New Orleans to join Dracula and his long-suffering familiar as we take a look at 2023's horror comedy, Renfield, directed by Chris McKay, with a script by Ryan Ridley based on a story by Robert Kirkman. The film stars Nicholas Hoult, Awkwafina, Ben Schwartz, playing the Lord of Leisure himself, the one and only Nicolas Cage. Joining me to take a bite of the neck of this film is writer, critic, novelist, broadcaster, and a man, I'm pretty sure, if there's anything to know about Dracula that he doesn't already know, it's not worth knowing. Kim Newman, how are you tonight, Kim?
I'm very well, thank you.
Well, I've got to ask you, as I ask all my guests when they first come on this podcast, is, are you a Nicolas Cage fan, Kim? Obviously, you're a film fan, you're a horror fan, but...
I've probably seen more of his works than the average viewer, because I do the director anything non-theatrical column in Empire. So I'm au fait with the two or three films he makes in between the films everybody's heard
of.
Which he does regularly, you know. So I've seen stuff like that. The one with the lions loose on the boat. The bank robbery set in America, shot in Bulgaria. All those films I've seen them as well as the top of the line Nicolas Cage film.
Amazing. You're a man in the trenches like me, Kim. Yes. I've been to those lowest of lows, and I've been to the highest of highs. So it's good to know. Yeah, it's amazing to know you're well versed in that stuff. What would have been the first Nicolas Cage film that you remember seeing, or was there one?
I know exactly what the first thing. It was Rumblefish.
What was the impact of, well, obviously that's not one that he, I don't know, what was well, the impact
I
from
mean,
that?
But it was the first film. Yeah. I looked it up and I hadn't seen, for instance, at that time, Fast Times at Ridgemont High or Valley Girl. I didn't catch up with those until later. So Rumblefish was the first film I saw him in. And obviously he's not the lead in that. He's just part of an ensemble. He's pretty good. And I think, and after that, weirdly, it was Racing with the Moon was, I think, the next of his films that was theatrically released in Britain, and I was working as a critic then, so I saw that. I have to say, it wasn't until I looked it up today that I even remembered he was in Racing with a film that, frankly, almost nobody remembers anyway. I haven't seen it since the press show.
I mean,
I remember Sean Penn's in it. It's a 1940s set. Kind of mixed up kid movie, but that's about it. Probably the first of the sort of starring performances would have been Peggy Sue Got Married, but I think that may well be the thing that most established him, you know, as an international act.
What was the did that leave a lasting impression on you, Kim? Like, were you like, I want to see more of this guy, or were you put off as the voice as Kathleen Turner was?
I thought he was good in that, actually. The one that everybody loves that I really didn't like was Moonstruck.
Uh-huh.
I remember a lot of people at the time liked it, and it's a film a lot of people have warmed up to over the years. I remember just thinking it was terrible. but that said, I loved Racing Arizona. And from there, it was like Wild at Heart and some of the more eccentric choices along the way. Vampire's Kiss, which I imagine we're going to talk about a bit.
Well, yeah, that was like 1987's like kind of like an important year in kind of Nicolas Cage's career, because he had Raising Arizona, Moonstruck, and I believe he filmed Vampire's Kiss. It was almost like this kind
but beforehand he was Francis Coppola's nephew, who was put in a couple of Coppola films. And I think probably it wasn't until around that period of having Peggy Sue, Moonstruck, Raising Arizona in a glut, it was like then he became an actor that people knew, he was a recognized name rather than just one of many people who were around.
And what
80s male ingenues, yeah.
So let's talk about Vampire's Kiss. Was that one that you managed to catch at the time, or is that one caught later?
Saw it at the press show, reviewed it for the Monthly Film Bulletin, I think. I liked it. I liked it then. I've seen it again. I like it now. It is certainly an eccentric movie.
Mm-hmm.
And probably a slightly misunderstood one, but yeah. I don't know if Robert Kirkman thought about it, but it's another film in which a vampire is a toxic boss.
Yes.
And I think that certainly Cage uses a few of the acting tricks, as it were, that he'd done in Vampire's Kiss. But I think that's because in Vampire's Kiss he is very much borrowing bits of Max Schreck in Nosferatu.
100%.
And of course, the film that he's not in, that he produced, Shadow of the Vampire, is all as Willem Dafoe as Max Schreck. An interview he did around that time, he pointed out that Max Schreck's performance in Nosferatu owes quite a bit to John Barrymore's performance in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And you can see that. There is a sort of a silent cinema style that he does sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly it's what he seems to associate with vampires.
Well, yeah, that's kind of Nicolas Cage's. Well, he kind of brings that in, right? We saw it pastiched in The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent that his favourite film is The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. But I think that's pulled from real Nicolas Cage, right? And the fact that...
He's always been like a film fan, a comics fan, and a genuinely wide cultural interest. Mm-hmm. And I think that manifests sort of throughout. There's something about Dracula and his family, isn't there? Because his brother made a Dracula movie.
Well, yeah, the tendrils go quite wide.
Yeah. He made that before his uncle made Bram Stoker's Dracula. even Sofia Coppola was in the TV show of What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah. And if you kind of like look at the Coppola family, like as I do on this podcast, and like a wider spectrum, and you look at like the Schwartzman side of the family. So John Schwartzman, who is a DOP. One of his early films was Rockula. So the canon films Dracula comedy, and then Dracula Untold as well, when they were trying to kind of revitalize the. Yeah.
So there's a thing, and I know that about the time that Francis Coppola made Dracula, he pointed out that in The Godfather, Marlon Brando is impersonating Dracula when he dies. Mm-hmm. He does that thing with the making fangs out of orange peel.
Yes.
And has a half that going that. So plainly, it's something that's the story means a lot to them. Yeah, as obviously it does to me.
You saying that, Kim, what was your first encounter of the character of Dracula? Was it through the book or was it through...
Officially, my first encounter was with the Bela Lugosi film. That was the transformational film in my life. I mean, however, of course, I can go back. Like, I think the first time I saw Dracula was on Doctor Who.
Amazing.
But the thing is, in that, it turns out to be a robot. but I know I'd seen Dracula in Carry On Christmas. Peter Butterworth plays Dracula in that. And I'm sure I'd seen comedians doing Dracula or that Bugs Bunny cartoon, stuff like that. But it was the Lugosi film is kind of where I come in to the genre and the character. And obviously, again, Renfield relates to that very closely.
Yeah, with that kind of amazing Dwight Fry performance, right, as Renfield, like kind of... It's a film, much to my shame, like I only kind of caught in the run-up to Renfield coming out, because it's kind of been a massive blind spot of mine. It's kind of like... One of the reasons I wanted to get you on the podcast was to kind of, I don't know, maybe like... give us some where this film kind of fits in the kind of, because there's a pantheon of Dracula in cinema, and like what do you think it is that this fascination with the character that is kind of revisited all the time, Kim?
It's not, because there are like two or three other Dracula movies coming up this year. And they never go away. I mean, I do this thing on social media, your daily Dracula, mm-hmm. where I post an image from a Dracula movie or TV show or game or advert, cartoon, whatever. And I thought that was going to last about 3 months, but we're coming up to 3 years and there is no end in sight. So it's something that absolutely permeates culture. I think you can probably not go through a day without coming across Dracula in some place, mm-hmm. or some reference, just if you're scrolling in the internet or reading newspaper, watching television, walking down the street, at some point in every day you will be confronted by the shadow of Dracula somewhere. And there are a few other things in culture that have that absolute all pervasiveness. Mm-hmm. There are some things that sort of loom big and then go away. It's like you know, Tarzan's huge pop cultural figure. There's a town named after Tarzan, which Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, owned, basically. But Tarzan, the last Tarzan film, didn't do any business. And it's like that was a story that they would go back to every couple of years, and it would always kind of click. The last, it seems maybe that is falling off the cultural radar. But Dracula and Sherlock Holmes and the Three Musketeers are still on.
Yes.
And A Christmas Carol and one or two other big popular culture things. They will remake every, Jekyll and Hyde is another one, and Frankenstein, Peter Pan. Mm-hmm. Yeah, every year you will get a version of one of those stories,
yes,
or a reboot or a reimagining or a remake. Alice in Wonderland. But there are like only 15 of these stories. Yeah, these mm-hmm. kind of multimedia franchises. And I suspect the more recent ones that are hemmed in simply by copyright or rights ownership. I'm thinking of James Bond or Batman, mm-hmm. which are wholly owned by corporations. The thing about Dracula and Frankenstein, Jekyll and Hyde, Three Musketeers, whatever, is that they are out of copyright. They are open source. Anybody can have a swing at them. And I think that means, of course, you get many, many more knockoffs and ripoffs and sort of lazy versions.
Well,
but you wouldn't have those if there wasn't a core of power there in the first place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If there wasn't so much really good stuff, that it's still possible to come up with new variations or new versions or new ideas. It's like the new spin on Dracula that you get in so many things, or even just going back to old stuff. I mean, there are so many things in the novel that you can extract and highlight and do as whole little films in themselves. Mm-hmm. The fact that we've got a film named after Renfield,
yes,
who is like in the cast list of the Dracula films or plays or TV shows, is like eight. Yeah. There's already been a film called Van Helsing. Mm-hmm. I think there is a film called Mina, and I there's a French art movie called Lucy in the Mirror. It's like when your supporting cast are famous,
yes,
when people know the names of archetypes. It's like, I mean, even outside the versions of Dracula or classic Gothic horrors, the archetypes of Van Helsing, Mina, Lucy, Renfield, you can find them in so many horror movies. Yeah, you can look at Alien has a Mina and a Lucy on board the Nostromo.
Yes.
Veronica Cartwright is the screaming woman who dies. Sigourney Weaver is the sensible woman who sort of bonds with the creature and lives.
Yes.
You see, that's Bram Stoker's idea. Yeah, and actually in Alien 3, Paul McGann plays Renfield to the alien. Yeah, so it's like that you can find these versions. You can find these characters or these archetypes seeded throughout horror. And some of them aren't necessarily things that Stoker invented,
mm-hmm.
but probably he put them in a form that was replicable.
What, like, you mentioned a point there about obviously the certain characters are now getting their own film, stuff like that. Obviously, on the horizon, we've got a film that is just one section of the novel,
the
right? But the boat, the boat's got its own film. But at this point,
I know that's been in development for a while. But again, Alien is the Demeter section of Dracula. A bunch of people on a boat, and the mysterious thing in the cargo hold is killing them off one by one. Yeah,
amazing.
And that's just one chapter of Dracula, and it's in strictly, it's the kind of thing that you could drop from the novel and it wouldn't make any difference, except it's brilliant.
Yes.
Because it doesn't feature any of the main characters. I mean, obviously it features Dracula, but not as a character that you actually see up close. He doesn't talk in it. He's just there, the monster. And I think that last year there was a film actually, I think, called Bram Stoker's Van Helsing, which was just Lucy. It was just Lucy being sick and you don't see Dracula. And that it makes you, and I think the people who made that realize that The Exorcist is the Lucy section of Dracula.
Yes, yeah.
It's the girl in the bed getting sick and nobody understands why. And various doctors come in and can't do anything. And then the wise character, the Van Helsing character, comes in and can do something, but at a terrible cost. Yeah, there it is. But again, that's another couple of chapters of Dracula that you can then turn into. And I've seen versions which is just Jonathan in the castle, the first couple of chapters. And some of the plays drop that and do just the drawing room stuff. And it may well be the fact that Dracula is a great popular novel, but not Dickens or Jane Austen. And actually, of course, Dickens and Jane Austen have had weird riffs and whatever. But people who adapt it often feel they have a license to fiddle with it, to draw things out, to do different stuff, which people who are adapting Shakespeare maybe don't.
Yes.
Although, again, there are plenty of Shakespeare modern day versions or, you know, Westerns or whatever.
What was it that kind of like drew you into the story of Dracula and kind of developed this love?
Well, let's say my first encounter with the story and the characters of the Bela Lugosi film, and I think it was him, it was Lugosi, the performance. That it's not, even for 1931, it's not like other film acting. The great monsters, Dracula is the one who can talk to you.
Yes.
And that actually is really good. I mean, Dracula doesn't talk much after the first couple of chapters, but he talks a lot in the first chapters. The Frankenstein monster in the book is articulate, but in the films he grunts. You know? but Dracula, you can have a conversation with. I think the thing that I find interesting about him as one of the archetypal monsters is that most monsters don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. You know, the Wolfman is cursed.
Yeah.
The Frankenstein monster is horribly abused by his parent. Dracula has chosen to be Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
He knows the difference between good and evil, and he has picked evil. He has picked being a predator, being a parasite. And that's all he wants to do, even though he is, cultured and sophisticated and has a breadth of skills and abilities and powers and a title and money and all this kind of stuff. He has chosen to be a complete bastard. because I think obviously there's room for all manner of interpretations, and I kind of like, George Hamilton with the suntan as Dracula, I think is very funny. But the ones I really like are Lugosi or Christopher Lee, where Dracula is just evil.
Mm-hmm.
I find the performances that you get from Gary Oldman or Frank Langella, where Dracula is trying to be romantic,
mm-hmm.
sort of don't quite click for me. He's still creepy. He still needs to be. And I think the story doesn't work if he's not a monster.
Yes. Yeah. Even though that Coppola one has got some really monstrous imagery, right? Of Dracula, like the kind of the look of Dracula in that is quite terrifying. Like I watched it quite recently, and it again, and it's like, oh. Obviously you've written novels about Dracula. What was it that kind of drew you to writing about Dracula?
Oh, well, for the novel, it was I was probably thinking of those. Do you know the Marvel comic series What If?
Yes, yeah.
It is a cartoon a while back, but the original comics from the 70s and the 80s. And DC had a similar thing called Imaginary Stories. And that's where you do an alternate version of a fictional character. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there have been plenty of, you know, what if the Nazis had won the war, or the British Empire had never fallen, or all these kind of stories. But my thought was, what if Dracula won? But I was thinking also of probably of those things of, you know, what if Spider-Man joined the Fantastic Four? All that, yeah. So just exploring the world of Dracula, but with a different plot and a different angle. And then once I got into that, it as a concept grew and became much more interesting to me, and I hope to the reader, in that the idea of Dracula winning, of taking over the country, of changing the world, was very appealing.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it kind of had a lot of contemporary resonance.
Yes.
It was the book's 30 years old now. Mm-hmm. So it was written under the influence of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. Or whatever. But it was republished last year in an anniversary edition. I thought what has changed in 30 years is that we all now know what it's like to wake up and discover that literally the worst person in the world is now in charge of the most powerful nation on the planet. And I think that may well be one of the reasons why the book is still in print. And people go, it's like people understand all too well now what it's like living with somebody, utterly self-obsessed, monstrous and unreasonable, in absolute charge.
Because in the story of Dracula, right, he kind of gives up his plans of world domination, doesn't he?
I'm never quite sure. Stoker obviously got more interested in the domestic story than the story or whatever. And so Dracula in the novel is actually kind of a loser. He's got these great plans, and then they're sidelined because he becomes obsessed with the wife of a junior solicitor. It's almost pathetic for a master villain to be brought down to this really petty level. And I think that there is a sense that when Dracula comes to London in the novel, he's out of his depth.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great line where somebody says that they've seen him walking by the Thames wearing a straw hat that doesn't suit him. And so he's like this tourist, the foreigner who doesn't quite get, Britain. And there's even a bit where they're doing that thing of going around the houses to destroy his coffin so he can't use them. And they find the sink where he's shaved. And he's not washed it out. And so it's got hair and foam and bits of blood around it. And you got this sort of idea of Dracula as somebody who's useless.
Yeah, some kind of like useless bachelor, right? Kind of like loafing around.
That Bram Stoker did that deliberately. I think it's a strain. You can't go too far in it because Dracula then becomes completely pathetic. I think the film that does that really well is Blood for Dracula with Udo Kier, where as somebody who is so completely out of time, that he's sort of wheelchair bound and feeble, and there are no virgins to drink anymore, he's horribly dependent on his servant, but he's still viciously abusive of him. And I think that again, it's a reading of the role. It makes Dracula a complicated villain in an interesting way.
Yeah. You've mentioned a few of the standout kind of Dracula films. What would you say are kind of, up there as like the totems of Dracula in
obviously
cinema?
Go with the Lugosi film. I've got a lot of time for Dracula's Daughter.
Mm-hmm.
There are things about Son of Dracula I really like as well, although I don't think Lon Chaney Jr. is a particularly good Dracula. Of the Hammer films, I really like the first couple, and actually some of the later ones, Taste the Blood of Dracula and the Satanic Rites of Dracula. Then it's Blood for Dracula, Udo Kier. I like the Louis Jourdan TV film, Count Dracula. And obviously Nosferatu.
Yes.
In both the Klaus Kinski, Werner Herzog version and the Max Schreck, F.W. Murnau
yes.
version. Then you get to stuff like, I suppose in the modern era, the Dracula to beat is Adam Sandler, who had more as probably, and he's not the first to play Dracula as a sitcom dad.
Yes.
That's a surprisingly common approach. There's the whole Monster High franchise, and there was an anime, Don Dracula, which seemed to have been first. There was a BBC show called Young Dracula. Again, this idea of Dracula as sort of out of touch but well-intentioned father. That's a reading. How the hell did that happen? Mm-hmm. How did one of our great icons of unregenerate evil become this guy? Maybe Grandpa Munster.
Yeah.
The thing that Turner, because the Munsters is a universal property, and so it is essentially the mutation of the Universal Pictures, the Karloff Frankenstein monster, Lugosi as Dracula, the Wolfman, all that lot. There, it's sort of the kids' version of that, the monster kid version.
Yes. So what were your thoughts when you first heard about them making Renfield?
I suppose I thought another one I can think of two novels about Renfield, and there's been a previous movie, Renfield the Vampire. Mm-hmm. It'd be gone over. I thought there were things about it that struck me as interesting. The fact it's a Universal film, I thought that because Universal have had various problems with keeping their monsters going.
Mm-hmm.
The Munsters had a fairly grim reboot this year, but I'm thinking of stuff like Van Helsing, Dracula Untold, mm-hmm. the Tom Cruise version of The Mummy. It's like they had all these properties and they sort of screwed them up.
Yeah.
They made big budget rubbish. They were going to, The Mummy was going to be the beginning of their kind of version of the Marvel movies, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Set up, they were going to do a whole bunch more. And it was just so disastrous that they scotched that. And then they went back. And the film, I think, is the template for Renfield, is the reboot they did of The Invisible Man, Elizabeth Moss, which took one of their less well-known franchises. I mean, they'd made four or five Invisible Man films, depending on whether you count the Abbott Costello picture. and going back, and again, that gave you a version of that story that was not one you had seen before. It told the story of the Invisible Man from the point of view of someone who couldn't see it, rather than from his point of view, which was very clever, it was very effective, and it worked and it did well. So I assume then Universal decided that they would do that with their mm-hmm. properties. They would go and make smaller scale, slightly more adult-oriented pictures that were allowed to be scary or to do different things. I think Renfield doesn't lean particularly into being frightening. It is a horror comedy rather mm-hmm. than a full-out horror movie. I have no real problem with that. I'd kind of like to see a scary Dracula next.
Yes. Yeah, because I guess even with The Invisible Man and Renfield, it seems that Universal is still kind of up in the air what they want to do, right? And then
the thing is, what they did in the 1930s and 40s, and probably the most important film they made was Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, mm-hmm. because that was the film that proved you could make a crossover. You could pull together disparate stories into a franchise. Yeah. The Avengers is essentially Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman or House of Frankenstein. You know, you establish a bunch of characters, you bring them together in one big team up. None of that would have been conceivable if it wasn't what Universal did in the 1940s. Then you get the issue that, obviously, if you're a company, you want that kind of a franchise. And they sort of managed it for a while with their previous reboot of The Mummy, the Brendan Fraser films, which I'm not even sure if that's definitively over, because I think they're still making Scorpion King movies. but that, the franchise, which some people have a fondness for, I didn't particularly care for it myself, but there was an ambition and scale there that kind of ruined. I don't know, because I understand that Renfield hasn't made the money they would have liked, so we're not going to be seeing more of those, which on the one hand, it doesn't really matter because I like it enough as it is, and maybe but it would be hard, for instance, to do a follow-up which had Renfield and the Invisible Man together, because the styles and tones and moods and approaches of the two movies are inimical. I mean, they don't really go together. You couldn't do a team up. I mean, or you could, but it would be a stretch.
Yes, massively.
Though in theory, Thor and Iron Man shouldn't be in the same film, but they managed to get away with it. Or indeed, Frankenstein and Dracula come from different universes of fiction.
Yeah, because you even kind of had it in the 90s, right, when they kind of, we had a resurgence where you had Coppola doing Dracula, you had Kenneth Branagh doing Frankenstein, and then wasn't there a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde movie?
Yes, there was Mary Riley.
Yes, yeah.
And, yeah, I think maybe every time somebody does one of these stories, you get, somebody else feels obliged to do them all, I think we're probably due a Frankenstein soon.
Yes, definitely. So what did you think of the casting of Nicolas Cage? Obviously, Dracula is such an iconic character.
I can see why he wanted to do it.
Yes.
but also I can see why that was something that seemed, from a creative point of view, it's a pitch, isn't it? Nicolas Cage as Dracula.
Yes.
But then the film isn't about him.
Mm-hmm.
And Nicholas Hoult does the heavy lifting. Yeah. And I think brilliantly. Yeah, he's a really interesting player. Obviously, people have underplayed Dracula effectively. Mm-hmm. Strangely, Klaus Kinski underplays Dracula. and Louis Jourdan, I think, does it brilliantly. It's one of the chilliest performances in the role, but it's kind of low-key and charming rather than the Christopher Lee fangs bared, hissing, snarling, or even Gary Oldman that goes for the throat, literally. And the scenery chewing, it's like, and I think obviously Nicolas Cage is having to compete with all of that. But also he's having to play, he's not just playing Dracula, he's playing Bela Lugosi's Dracula.
Yes.
Just as Nicholas Hoult is playing Dwight Fry's Renfield, not Bram Stoker's. So you get, again with his interest in silent cinema, he does seem to be doing Lon Chaney in London After Midnight, that lost vampire movie.
Yeah.
The teeth, he's even wearing the same hat.
Yeah, and the teeth, right?
Yeah, and the shark teeth is very Lon Chaney. But I'm glad to see that it's not just an imitative performance. It is a version of Dracula we've not seen. The kind of wheedling, manipulative, toxic boss And I think the thing that I was impressed is the bits where Dracula turns around and is dependent and guilt trips Renfield.
Yes.
You know, that is sort of, again, that's not a Dracula we've seen before, but it's quite effective.
Yeah, there's that amazing scene, that like two-hander between them when he comes to visit him in his apartment, right? That kind of like, you get this, he's almost like love bombing him and then making him feel guilty for like, I need you, Renfield. Like, yeah. why have you done this to me? And like making him out to be the monster in this kind of weird codependent relationship. So good, because this film acts right as a direct sequel to the 1931 Todd Browning film.
I think it's the first sequel since Dracula's Daughter in 1935, which I thought was great. Yeah, and it even uses the font from the poster,
yes,
for the title, and which I thought was wonderful. I suppose, like The Invisible Man, it's a study of a toxic relationship. And maybe that's not a bad way of rebooting your monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And logically, the next one is Frankenstein, which is about parents.
Yeah.
Because you've had The Invisible Man, which is about a toxic boyfriend. Dracula is a toxic boss, and Frankenstein is a toxic parent. and that would make a good trilogy. Yeah. I think they're doing Bride of Frankenstein, or okay, that was on the cards as a possible next one. I will say that that two-hander scene in Renfield's apartment, I don't know if they've done it deliberately, but it uses a joke from one of the Anno Dracula books.
Ah, amazing.
The thing about the welcome mat. I made that up.
Amazing. Yeah, I love that. Like, what, did you know beforehand that it was going to be a sequel? Was it kind of when you saw
I didn't. I mean, and I saw quite an early screening.
Mm-hmm.
I think I may even have seen it with, yeah, the effects weren't 100% finished when I saw it. So I went in not even knowing. I mean, I'd seen the trailer, which it slightly misrepresents the film, but in an interesting kind of way. So it wasn't, it literally came as a surprise to me where they went with it.
Yes.
And I thought that the choice of making a follow-up to the Lugosi film and starting with the footage from it, and I mean, just for people who are not Dracula obsessives, in the 1931 Bela Lugosi film, Renfield goes to Castle Dracula as Jonathan Harker does, mm-hmm, in the book. And Keanu Reeves as Jonathan Harker in the Coppola film, or the character in Nosferatu. But by having Renfield go to the castle and then go mad, that means that he has something to do in both sections of the narrative. In many films, the Hammer film kills off Jonathan Harker after the castle section, because there's not that much more for him to do.
Yeah.
Remember what Keanu Reeves does in the rest of the Coppola film? He comes back with white hair.
Yeah.
Other people are carrying the narrative.
Yeah.
It's almost certainly down to Garrett Ford and John Balderston, who wrote the 1931 film, because it's not the case in the play. But you have this thing of Renfield being your through line,
mm-hmm,
the guy who goes to Transylvania and brings Dracula back and then becomes his minion. Bela Lugosi is a pop culture immortal, mm-hmm, but so is Dwight Frye.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, Alice Cooper wrote a song about him. And it's you saw the film the first time recently. Mm-hmm. Isn't it the most surprising performance in the movie?
What?
Dwight Frye.
Yes. Yeah. It's kind of like, it's got this menace to it. It's surprisingly funny. Like, he's great at it.
Not that laugh. Yeah, it's like everybody remembers to do Lugosi's Dracula voice. I noticed that Nicholas Holt does Dwight Rice laugh.
Yes.
At one point. It is, I think it, the strangest, Peter McNichol did it in Dracula Dead and Loving It, a film that really doesn't work. But Peter McNichol's Renfield is really good in that. Yeah. And that actually also uses, I think, most of the script of the Lugosi film. As indeed does the 1970s porn movie, Dracula Sucks.
Amazing.
Which also features a Renfield who does that laugh.
Amazing. So how, obviously, yeah, somebody who's well-versed on all things Dracula, how well does Renfield kind of stick to the lore of the character, or does it bend it?
Well, it makes stuff up, which sort of, it has this thing of Dracula giving Renfield some of his powers in order to keep him alive,
mm-hmm.
Which it's not absolutely original to this film. It has been done before in some ways. I mean, I think it's even done in the Love at First Bite, the George Hamilton movie, has Renfield, Artie Johnson plays it in there as somebody who's preserved out of time along with Dracula. But this is the film that explains the mechanics of how he's done it. And I think it fits in quite nicely. It's sort of a thought through mm-hmm. version of vampirism.
Yeah, and there's like the his blood brings you back to life, right? And it kind of like,
yeah.
Were you surprised as I was by like the gore in this film? Because it's quite gruesome, right?
It is. It's very gruesome, but it's somehow not upsetting.
Yeah.
People you don't like having terrible things done to them.
Yeah, and it does that kind of Evil Dead 2 thing, right? By turning the violence up to 11, that you kind of like go, oh, it's broached into funny now, as opposed to being disturbing.
And I think it's Nicholas Holt and Awkwafina in the middle of it, the sort of sweet,
mm-hmm.
and that gives you someone to relate to. For instance, I mean, I quite like the current Evil Dead Rise,
mm-hmm.
but it gives you nobody.
No.
it's like you come out of it and it's been amazing, but a couple of days later, I couldn't quite remember who everybody was and how they related, what the plot story was. But it's got gruesome and horrible things happening. And it's kind of nasty, whereas Renfield, strangely, is kind of sweet.
Yeah. It kind of like walks this tightrope, right, of kind of balancing. It kind of sidelines the horror completely to be like a kind of...
My preference would be for a Dracula who's scarier at some point. And who knows, maybe The Voyage of the Demeter will actually do that. We'll go with... And of course, there's another version of Nosferatu due as well. So that... Yeah, who knows what? Yeah, how that's going to pan out?
Yeah. I'm sure it will be very period specific, as it's a Robert Eggers film. It will be very.
I look forward to it.
Amazing. So, let's talk about Nicolas Cage's performance. You said he's doing Bela Lugosi. What kind of Were there things that you liked about his performance,
I like the fact that he's doing Bela Lugosi. He doesn't do the kind of an impressionist Bela Lugosi. He's doing stuff like the gestures rather than the voice. The voice is easy. I mean, the thing is, if you just do a Bela Lugosi impersonation, you get Adam Sandler.
Yes.
And you can't get away with that. And the weird little tittering and giggles he does. There's a bit of Max Schreck there. It's a sort of self-delighted villain. You know, the guy who knows how bad he is and lets you know that he doesn't. I mean, I suppose it's almost a Disney villainess reading of Dracula, isn't it? Yeah, I liked the look as well. I thought that the the costume was good. The the teeth and the outfit. It's still it's effectively striking without just being the because again, if you get into Bela Lugosi's costume now, you look like Grandpa Munster.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and it's kind of like, I tell you, there is a timelessness to it. Yeah, kind of like the it's like quite modern cuts to the necks and stuff like that of the clothes he's wearing. Like I found him just like you said before, it kind of on paper as a pitch, Nicolas Cage seems perfect in the role, right? It's like he's kind of wanted to do this role, you'd imagine, ever since, I don't know, 1987, he had a stab at it with Vampire's Kiss, and it's kind of like he's been chomping at the bit to do it ever since.
I wouldn't be surprised if he's of the generation that would have seen the Lugosi film on television when he was a kid. I mean, I'm sure that's it. It's like, for instance, I know that because I know people who worked on it, Benicio del Toro made the Wolfman because his favorite as a kid was Frankenstein meets the Wolfman.
Amazing.
And he hoped it would be a big enough hit. He said that apparently he and his brother used to play Frankenstein meets the Wolfman. This thing, that's what he really wanted to do. And actually, the Wolfman was another Universal horror reboot that didn't really click.
So where would you say that Renfield kind of fits within the canon of Dracula films? Do you think it would be one that will stand the test of time? Obviously, we're talking at a time when it kind of hasn't.
Just out.
Yeah.
Certainly, for a while, it had seemed likely. As I said, the most successful Dracula reboot of the last 30 years is Hotel Transylvania.
Yes.
Then there's a whole bunch of terrible films. I mean, Van Helsing, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which Dracula isn't in, but Mina is. Dracula Untold, I thought was all right, but it didn't click. There was that Jonathan Rhys-Meyers TV series. I quite like the BBC's stab at it with Clay Spang.
Mm-hmm.
But the last episode of that threw it all away. The Blade Trinity has one of the worst Draculas ever. Yeah. And so did Van Helsing. Yeah. And so Renfield is mainly because the competition has been pretty poor, is up there as one of the best Draculas of the 21st century. We'll be interested to see, because besides The Voyage of the Demeter, Chloe Zhao is working on a science fiction Western Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Eggers is doing Nosferatu, and Marvel are doing Blade.
Yes.
And they just announced Mia Goth was playing Lilith, who is in the comics the daughter of Dracula. So presumably Marvel must be, looking around for somebody. They'll get Antonio Banderas or somebody to come in and play the Tomb of Dracula version of Dracula.
Amazing. And obviously, Renfield is a horror comedy. Like, as somebody who's kind of, made a name for yourself as kind of being a master of knowing all things about horror, what's your kind of thoughts in general on the kind of horror genre, horror comedy genre as a whole?
I've got no problem with it. I mean, it's very much a matter of mood. And horror comedy has been part of the cinema genre since The Cat and the Canary in the silent period, or The Old Dark House. And I love those. I think it helps probably if you can actually have proper scary stuff and proper laughs. I'm not a fan of the trauma approach to cinema,
mm-hmm.
where you put a couple of jokes in because you haven't got anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and if you then sort of defensively say, oh, it was supposed to be shit.
Yeah.
Defuse the criticism. But so I think it needs a bit more mouse than that. It's not an easy mix to pull off. But when it's pulled off well, it works.
Because obviously they're both pulling from a similar reaction from people, right? They're both looking for involuntary reaction to a film from the audience, right? But one is either you want someone to laugh, the other is you want them to be scared. So they almost, I don't know, they always seem...
Well, it's the thing they say that when you preview a comedy or a horror film, you don't even have to read the cards to know that it's working or not. But if it's like a rom-com or a drama or an action movie, even, you don't know until people tell you, that they're up on a high. Yeah. With horror, you could actually stand in the lobby and know whether it's working. And certainly with comedy, you get that. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, yeah, as we start to wrap things up, Kim, this is a silly question I ask people based on the films we discuss. Obviously, we've looked at Renfield today. Based on this film alone, Kim, is Nicolas Cage the greatest actor of all time?
He's not even the greatest actor in the Beatles. Is the outstanding performer in this film, as it should be, because it's called Renfield.
Yes.
I think it's a really good supporting performance.
Yeah.
And actually, I also think it's a very canny move on Cage's part to take Dracula as a supporting role.
100%.
Rather than just go through the... Yeah, just be another Dracula in a Dracula-centric movie.
And it's quite a generous performance from him, right? In the fact that
you get this from people who work with him as well. For somebody who is a very large performer, he doesn't stamp on other actors. There are other actors that people don't want to work with when they're there. No matter how brilliant they are, they're a nightmare to be on screen. But I think obviously, in the last phrase, the way that he works with Nicholas Hoult here, or with Pedro Pascal in The Unbearable Weight of Immense Talent, shows that he's a great two-hand actor, two-foot actor, all the way back to Laura Dern in Wild at Heart or Holly Hunter in Raising Arizona. He knows when he can get people to match him.
I always find it fascinating, like watching Cage on screen, and like you're saying, like the way he bounces off people. And I've managed to like interview countless amounts of people who've worked with him, and they kind of say, not just is he a lovely guy, just like his work ethic is insane as well. Like even Nicholas Hoult was saying for this film, like weeks out, Nicolas Cage was off book. Like knew the film inside out. So Kim, now you get to program a triple bill of films based around Renfield's got to be in there, but one of them is a Nicolas Cage film, another one is a Dracula film. What are you programming? I
mean, there are no choices. It's Dracula, Bela Lugosi, right? And it's Vampire's Kids.
Perfect.
Which is actually probably underrated. A Nicolas Cage film. It's not really a vampire movie, unless you accept that Jennifer Beals maybe actually is playing a vampire, but Nicolas Cage isn't. But it's certainly one of the films where Cage goes to extremes. It's probably a more disturbing film than Renfield, isn't it?
100%. And it feels like a film that was like ahead of its time in a weird way. It feels
because people weren't talking about the entertainment industry like that. Yeah, so because he's an agent, isn't he? That's the yeah. I think he's a literary agent rather than a show business agent. But the harassment of his secretary in that, I suppose everybody in the movies knew people like that.
Yes,
and that clearly informs the performance. But I think it is one of Cage's more terrifying roles.
Yeah, and it's. I think the film kind of acts as a, I don't know, like a really damning on kind of 80s yuppie culture as well, in the way that American Psycho does. And that's kind of a film that has won the hearts and kind of, do you mean, you look at something like Letterboxd and it's always one of the most watched films and stuff like that. People love it. But it feels like with Vampire's Kiss, because it was poking fun at the time that it was made in the 80s, it's like almost like, oh no, we can't look at ourselves as these gross, grotesque people. It's
I really like the movie of American Psycho, but I think that it's possible to be an American Psycho and like that movie. Vampire's Kiss, it's much harder to get behind and think that that guy is your role model. Peter Lowe, is your role model.
He's loathsome, isn't it? He's kind of like grotesque. Even before he starts doing the Max Schreckisms and the Nosferatu moves. Amazing. So I like to always close out with any guest I have on, Kim, by asking them which is their favourite Nicolas Cage film. So which is yours?
Cross up between Raising Arizona and Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans.
Yeah, fantastic choices. Two different sides of Cage as well. You get kind of doing Roadrunner and doing one of a deplorable kind of a policeman. Amazing. So where's the best place? What have you got coming up on the horizon, Kim? Any books to look forward to?
I'm working on a novel, but it won't be out for a while. Probably the thing that at the moment, I'd say the 30th anniversary edition of Anna Dracula is out there. As I say, check me on social media every day for Your Daily Dracula, which is archived on my website. So amazing. You can catch up with 3 years worth of Draculas.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Kim, for coming and getting caged in with me.
Oh, happy to do it.
And there we have it, ladies and gentlemen. A massive thank you once again to Kim Newman for joining me. What an absolute delight it was to have, as I said at the intro of this podcast, an absolute legend in what he does. Absolute fountain of knowledge. And I like the fact that Kim probably wasn't up for my shit. The episode was probably a bit different to how it usually was. Some of that is because I was nervous, guys. I was kind of in awe. Kim is somebody who I massively look up to. And I know it's something I should get better at. It's just people at the end of the day, we're just having a conversation about a mutual interest and a passion, which is film. But you know what? Sometimes you get a bit nervous around people and the... That is what happened here. But all in all, it was a fun time had for me and hopefully a fun time had for you. If you agree with our views on Renfield or want to carry on the conversation about all things Dracula, please do so by heading over to all the socials. So that is at Caged In Pod on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Letterboxd and TikTok, where you can find me over there, or you can drop me an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. As for next week here on the pod, we're taking a little 2 week hiatus of any new episodes next week to celebrate Sofia Coppola's birthday. I am re-releasing my conversation with the fantastic
Mary Wilde, all about her 2010 film, Sofia Coppola's, that is, not Mary's. I'm sure Mary would make amazing films, but she hasn't made any and certainly didn't make one in 2010. But yeah, we talked about Somewhere. It's one of the earlier episodes of Coppola Connections and was a fantastic chat. So you'll be able to listen to that again or listen to that for the first time next week. And then the week after, well, we may just have a break or we may just pull something else out of the archives to release to you guys to listen to. The reason for this brief hiatus is some of you may know, a lot of you probably won't, but I am in the process of recording the first season for a new podcast called Getting Defoe You, like what we've done here with Nicolas Cage by watching every single film in his filmography. Me and Daryl Edge, who you would have heard here on this podcast and of Cage Rage fame, are embarking on, yeah, the entire filmography of Willem Dafoe, which if you just do a little Google is a mammoth task. And we just really wanted to get the ball rolling and, yeah, just booked basically an insane recording schedule. You don't really need to know the ins and the outs. All you need to know is to keep an eye out for that as well. You can find that on all the socials. So that is at Getting Defoe. No, that is get. That is at Defoe You Pod on all the socials as well. So check out there for any announcements on when that will be released. But yeah, we've got some fun stuff lined up and already in the can, and we'll be announcing when that podcast will be launching very, very soon. So I hope you join us over there for that as well. If you've enjoyed this episode or any other episode of the podcast, please head on over to patreon.com/CagedInPod, where you can support the podcast financially. Or you can head on over to TeePublic, especially if you're a US listener, and grab some amazing shirts designed by the fantastic Tim Sinclair. Or you can head on over to Etsy and I think you'll be able to type in Caged In Pod, find the store, and there's a couple of designs up on there which I would recommend for UK listeners more so than US, just because of shipping. Shipping to the US works out really expensive from UK printers on that, whereas TeePublic are international or US based. So I set up two different stores just to make it cheaper for you guys, depending on which side of the ocean you live. If you don't want to part with any money, that is absolutely fine. You can support the podcast by heading over to YouTube and joining Caged In TV, our brand new venture where I'll be uploading videos, where it's stuff that is adjacent to the podcast, stuff that I can want to talk about but don't really feel like I have an episode in me as such, just kind of video essay-esque content and kind of think pieces, if you will, that will be debuting up on there and staying there. Or again, you can head on over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now and giving me a lovely 5-star rating and review. Remember in your rating and review to let me know, what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation? Or what is your favourite Nicolas Cage film? And each and every answer will be read out on the podcast. So, as ever, guys, I've been Petros Patsilivas. I've been Caged In. You've been amazing, and I'll catch you next time.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.